Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Each week, I present interviews with independent bookshop owners from around the globe, authors, and specialists in subjects dear to my heart, the environment and social justice. To help the show reach more people, please share it with friends and family and on social media. And remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. You're listening to episode 200. Heidi Stemple didn't want to be a writer when she grew up. In fact, after she graduated from college, she became a probation officer in Florida. It wasn't until she was 28 years old that she gave in and joined the family business, publishing her first short story in a book called Famous Writers and Their Kids Write Spooky Stories. The famous writer was her mum, author Jane Yolen. Since then, she has published more than 35 books and numerous short stories and poems, mostly for children. Heidi lives and writes on a big old farm in Massachusetts that she shares with one very large cat who lives inside, and a dozen deer, a family of bears, three coyotes, two bobcats, a gray fox, tons of birds, and some very fat groundhogs who live outside. Once a year, she calls owls for the Audubon Christmas bird count. Hi, Heidi, and welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Hi, Mandy. I've been looking forward to our talk today.
Likewise. And I think you're the second or third children's author I've had on the show. And one of those is your mum.
I was going to say, I know about one of them because I'm related to her.
Well, today is all about you. So let's begin with learning about you and what you were doing before you became a children's fiction and nonfiction author.
Well, it's actually funny. I was thinking about it today before talking with you, and I was thinking, well, almost everybody in children's books knows this funny story. But then I thought, well, that's probably not true. And also, you have an audience that's really varied. So I began writing professionally at 28, and I thought that was so late in the game. It was very much my second career. And now as my daughter turns 28, I laugh so hard because she's just starting her career. Graduating from law school. So the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree on all of our generations. So I've just told you that my daughter's graduating from law school, and my first career was in law enforcement. So I was a probation parole officer in Broward County, Florida, and I worked with felonies, and I worked in and out of both jails and prisons, as well as having an office and working in the courthouse. So I did that. And when I actually became a private investigator after that, and was about to move back into victims' rights when I found out I was pregnant with this daughter, who's now 28. So you can see how the 28-year-old things comes into play. I received a job I interviewed for, and I got the position working at a battered women's shelter. And I found out the day before they called me to say I'd had the job that I was pregnant with Madison. And I was not a good pregnant person. I was a very sick pregnant person. So I turned down the job. And I thought, well, I'll go back to working soon, but I have to get to where I can leave the house first. And my mom emailed me. This was in the early days of email even, and said, I am supposed to write a story, and I could ask your brother, but while you're home, would you like to write a short story, a ghost story with me for a book called Famous Writers and Their Kids Write Spooky Stories? So she was shocked when I said yes. And that was my first published short story with her in that book. And it's funny, I didn't realize at the time, and I tell this a lot to my writing students, which is I didn't really realize how much of my life was put into that story. So it's a ghost story about a girl going to her grandmother's house. I remember I was pregnant with my mother's first grandchild. We put it in the house where my mother lives in my mind. I don't think she was thinking it was in her house, but to me, it was in this grandmother's house. And my mom was about to become a grandmother. And the girl has to solve the crime of why this ghost had become a ghost. And of course, in the end, she finds out that this was a battered woman and she was killed by her husband. As soon as they solve the mystery, the ghost is, you know, free to move on. And I had no idea until about 12 or 13 years later, how many pieces of my story had wound up in that short story, which is hilarious because as a writer now, 29 years later, I am very aware of how much I put of my life, my kids' life, my surroundings, even if it's just the bird that I heard today is the bird that winds up in my story. Or I had a little incident with a stoat, which is a small weasel, and it wound up being almost killed in a book because it upset me. So I almost killed it off in a book. It got away, thankfully. But all those little pieces become texture to what you're writing, intentionally, like I do now, because I'm much more aware of it, or very unintentionally, like I did back then as a baby writer. And that becomes part of what tethers your stories to reality, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, because even if you're doing a fantasy story, it really still has to be tethered to the reality of that world. And so those details that are in your life really come into play. All that law enforcement and problem solving, I don't want to say crime solving because I wasn't solving any crimes, but I was doing a lot of investigative work. Even as a probation officer, you're asked to write PSIs, which are pre-sentence investigations, which means you're really looking into the background of the person who committed the crime, and you're presenting all of that to the judge so that they can make a sentencing decision. And so you're really digging into the background of a person and looking at it into the context of society. And that sort of stuff that I did then is very similar to what I do as a writer every day.
I love what you said about observing, because I feel that any creative endeavor requires developing the observing skills. And in the case of a writer, that can mean developing backstories for characters, understanding character traits, where did they derive, understanding their surroundings, and writers definitely hone in on these observation skills to the point that it could be maddening for friends and relatives around you, because sometimes you just sit back and observe and watch humanity in action.
It's true. I had written down some notes today, and that really ties into those, which is wonder and curiosity. And I think that creative people have that. Maybe we don't have it any more than anybody else, but I think it's really in the front part of our brain. And that's not a biology technical thing, because I don't actually know what happens in the brain or where it happens, but we're more clear on it happening. I had a funny thing happen recently. My significant other's name is Dennis, and he is very confused all the time about my brain. He teaches special ed in a high school. So he has a very, it's a job. There's stuff going on that I am so glad humans like him can handle, because I know that I couldn't. I know that is not a job for me. But he's always confused about the creative brain. And he said to me a couple months ago, and I had to do some thinking about it, and I came back to him with the good answer. But he likes to have the radio on all the time. We will go someplace and he puts the radio on. And I will be saying, can you please turn that off? My brain's working. The minute you turn it on, my creative brain stops. I can't write. I can't revise. I can't let stuff go on. But he is confused all the time by me driving with the sound off. A quiet car to him is like torture. And here I am, I'm perfectly happy, and I can drive 4 or 5 hours with nothing on. And I had to explain it to him. I'd never had to explain it to anyone before. And I said, the creative brain works differently. And everybody's creative brain works differently. My particular creative brain needs silence. That's when I may not be really actively thinking about it, but that's when my brain's working stuff out. It's fixing problems in plots. It's suggesting ways to unstick a problem that's stuck. It's creating characters. It's creating conflict. It's doing all those things that it's hard to just sit down and tell it to do, sometimes, but it's really untangling threads that have gotten tangled up in the writing of something.
I completely agree. I think the silence is really important.
Yeah. He was so amazed. He's like, well, nobody's ever explained it to me. And I've always, for all these years, just thought, you're weird. You listen, you can be in a car with nothing going on. And so it was interesting to, because I think people who are creative know that instinctively, whatever it is, it may be classical music. You may work with classical music. I know a lot of artists write specific playlists in order to draw a particular project because they want to get into a certain mind place. And everybody's is different. You may need a coffee shop with that ambient noise going on. You may need the absolute silence of a cabin in the woods, but we understand our process, but explaining it to somebody else, it's bizarre. And it's actually an interesting thing to try and explain your process to somebody who doesn't work in a creative career.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I completely understand and relate to what you've just said. Now, I was wondering, when I was going through your body of work, was there a defining moment when you chose to write for children instead of adult fiction?
So you think I chose? That's funny. No, I was thinking about that too. And there wasn't a choice made so much. You know, I started in children's literature because that's what my family does. Both my brothers work in and around children's book as well, not as their primary career, but they also do. And that's where my mother's career is. And so when I sort of got dragged into the family business, which is how we call it, I was not kicking and screaming, but it wasn't my first choice. I started really becoming more focused in children's literature. I do have one adult book that I did with my mom. I have one published adult short story in an anthology that I did solo. And so I do that. But you know what? I don't read adult literature very much. I absolutely prefer children's literature. I read some YA. I read a lot of middle grade, and I read picture books. I'm not exaggerating that I read picture books every day. My house is filled with them. I teach writing picture books, so I try and keep up in the market really solidly. But you know what? I prefer it. I love it. There's this wonder that happens at that moment in time, at every moment in time. I write across genres. I know that we've sent you some of my board books, so that's the books for the tiniest reader.
You're talking about something like Whose Nest Is Best?
Whose Nest Is Best, which is illustrated by Gareth Lucas. I know two Gareths, so sometimes I get the last names wrong. It's a board book, but it's also a lift the flap book. So board books are super interactive with kids. You sort of have to think about how a child is going to interact with the book object as well as the book art, which I don't do, but I am. You know, I'm always thinking about it when I'm writing the words, as well as your words. So that's for the youngest kids. And then picture books are sort of the next step. And those are for the kids who are more into, and this is always, it slides over between these age groups, of course. So it's not totally specific, but picture books are for kids in the lap, usually. So they're still interacting with the triad, with the reader, the listener, and the book, and sort of in the background, the author and illustrator, but they're not there. And of course, they go to much older books. And I've written for all of these, and I just love that. And then you move into, I know we sent you as well, readers, which are the ready to reads, which never get any glory. So that's why I thought it would be fun to send you those. Because those are for a real, real moment in time, that the tiniest moment, the shortest moment for most children, which is when they go from being a listener to a reader. And it's so magical. Since I've started writing these, and honestly, if I could never write anything but readers ever again, I might have to choose that, because I love this magical moment. I have been at book festivals or in bookstores where kids' parents bring them up clutching that book, and the child will put the book in front of me and start reading it to me. Some of them easily, some of them decoding letter by letter, sound by sound. And I mean, there's nothing more amazing than that But it's short because the minute they get good at that, they move into older books. So middle grade chapter books, and then middle grade novels, and then YA, and out into the wild, crazy wild west of adult books, but which I know nothing about.
And how many times have we heard someone say, oh, I could write a children's book, and they really don't have any idea of the skills required to write children's stories and the skills that are required to illustrate children's books. For example, the shape book that your publisher sent to me.
So you're talking about People Shapes, which is illustrated by Teresa Bellon. And I love her color palette. It's absolutely divine. And that book actually has the die cut pages, which are the shapes. And again, that's a board book. So it's about the child interacting not only with the book itself as an object, as well as my words and the pictures. So it's when you're writing for those different ages and in those different formats, it's so much fun to sort of stretch your thinking about how a child is interacting with the book. Now, to be clear, I try not to think about the child reader when I'm writing, because the primary thing is to tell a good story, no matter whether that's a story that has a plot, or more like the board books that don't usually have a plot. They're more of a concept book, because you want that to be, you want the good story, and I'm using, again, story loosely, to be primary. And then you start going back and thinking about the child reader. But I love that.
And can you share with us a few of the specific themes, rules, and skills a children's author needs to understand in order to appreciate how to write for children?
Okay, so this is going to sound funny. I love the rules. I love a deadline. I love a specific format of a book, because every book has its own rules. So again, we're going back to like the board books. They have rules because they need to be really short. The page number is different. That you need to interact as much with the art, maybe more so with the art. The text is almost secondary, because it may just be the sounds of it that the child is interacting with. When you move into picture books, there are rules. There are 32 pages. I teach a lot of other writers, and so we spend a lot of time looking at those rules. There's word counts, but it is more about the story being primary, the text being primary in conjunction with the art. I don't mean above the art. It's always in conjunction with the art in children's books. And the age is important. When you move into the readers, like these ready to reads that Simon and Schuster do, that I actually have six of them. Three of them are published.
I have them right here. Flamingo Bingo, Chicken Karaoke, and Toucan with Two Cans.
Yes. And you can look forward to Eagles in the End Zone, which is the turkeys and the eagles in flag football. And then you can look forward to Dodo Dodgeball. And the final one will be Penguin Parade, where all of the birds come back. And these are romps. They're not about actual birds. They're very silly. But for those, because they're in the ready-to-read format, and these are level one, there are rules about how many words can go in each sentence and on the page. The books are 250 words or less. And we don't use contractions, because we're really teaching simple reading. So I love that kind of rules. And then I'm working on chapter books right now, and there's a difference between a chapter book and a novel, a middle grade novel, and it has to do with size. And so, yeah, I actually really enjoy those. And I don't think of them as rules so much as parameters, because then you have to work creatively within those parameters, and it makes everything kind of a puzzle, which I love.
I remember when I first spoke with your mom, she mentioned that you and her teach classes together. Is this something you still do?
We do teach. I teach at several different places. And I think what you're talking about is we did for a while our picture book boot camps, which we did. Those are master classes. So it was only people who are already published. But this weekend coming up, which will probably by the time this podcast, it will be a couple weekends ago, I am teaching nonfiction, nature nonfiction, a workshop, and an intensive about how to fix a picture book manuscript that isn't working. And that's through SEBWI, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And I teach a lot at Highlights, which is a retreat center for all different types of children's literature classes. So I do a lot of teaching of other writers, and that's really fun.
And is that information available on your website?
It should be. It may not be. It's HeidiEYStemple.com, because here's a lesson for creative people who don't want to bother with websites, because that is not a creative endeavor and it's not any fun. Make sure you don't stop paying for your website domain, because I don't own HeidiStemple.com anymore. So I'm HeidiEYStemple.com.
Heidi, one thing I noticed about your books, they are flavored with nature. Is nature where you draw metaphors for life experience that carry easily into children's stories? There was one story I read of yours about a little mouse on a boat. It's such a sweet, sweet story.
That book is called Adrift. And yes, the nature aspect of that was, of course, the ocean. And that was definitely a metaphor for scary things and being afraid and alone. And the book itself started out and is very much a metaphor for the pandemic, because it was how we were all feeling. And I know it's helped a lot of people sort of through that feeling of being afraid and coming together at the end of something. But yeah, nature and primarily birds, you'll find in almost everything I do. I mean, I love them silly, like as in the readers. I use them in nonfictions, which, like, Whose Nest Is Best is nonfiction for the tiniest readers. But my mom and I have a book called You Nest Here With Me, which is birds as well. And that those bird nests are a metaphor for feeling safe in your own home. So we've definitely used them as metaphor, but also quite literally, I am a bird watcher. My dad was a bird watcher. He taught all of us. Owl Moon, which was my mom's book, The Caldecott 1988, illustrated by John Schoner. It is a real family story. My dad took my brothers and myself out owling as kids. So those moments really did happen in our family. But one of the things that I'm really clear on, and again, I'm teaching nature nonfiction this weekend, so I've been thinking a lot about it, that I take my ambassadorship for owling as such as it is, because being the little girl in Owl Moon, but in all of my books, I have one called Counting Birds, which is the history of the Audubon Christmas bird count, a nonfiction for pretty young children. I take that really seriously, because though I live on a 15-acre farm, I was brought out with trusted adults into the field to call owls. I was at all of that I was able to do as a child. But there are so many kids who don't have trusted adults, or don't have nature in their backyard, or don't live by the ocean, or don't have anyone to teach them about birds. Our books are those things. Our books are the backyard. Our books are the owls at night. Our books are the adventure into the backyard, or back into history, or into that ocean. And so I take what we're doing, even if it's super silly, even if it's about being afraid because you're a duck and you've walked into chicken karaoke, those things are equally important. Those are allowing children to see that they're not the only person feeling that way, or they're able to see. We talk about windows and mirrors. So a mirror is reflecting what you're feeling or seeing back on yourself. So you're not alone. You also are that duck being afraid to get on stage, but also they're windows. So you can look out into this new and different thing, be it owling or be it back into history to see how the bird count started. So those are all really important. So metaphors, yes, but also quite real, so that children can experience new things in these books.
Now we know the amount of work that you put into writing these children's books. How does your writing practice look? Do you write every day, or do you go on writing retreats, or do you have a daily schedule?
I would love to be the type of writer who tells you that I have, I do yoga in the morning and I sip my tea and then I sit down at my computer and my writing process is not anything like that. And honestly, I know very few people who actually have that kind of ability to have that space in their lives. Many of us are moms or dads. Many of us have, because if our career is the one at home, we're the one doing all the home stuff. I am a single mom. So when I was writing a lot of this stuff, it was being done in the ballet lobby. It was being done during naps. So a lot of writing is done in the interstices of our lives. And my mom, who has published her, if you don't know, my mother is author Jane Yolen. She has now 427 books out. And she's one of the authors that does get to sit down and write for as much as she wants. And that's because she has an assistant who does all of those chores that keep you from writing, making sure the contracts are done, making sure travel arrangements are done, filing taxes, organizing receipts, organizing travel stuff. And that's me. That's my day job.
Oh, my goodness.
So why do you think my website might not be up to date? Because I'm making sure that hers is. So that's my day job. And I know tons of writers, tons of authors, published authors that you might think, well, they write a lot of stuff. Listen, I am signing the contract on my 46th book, but I do that in the interstices. Now, that being said, I have a great boss who completely respects my creative career as well. So I had about 1,500 words I needed to write on the second book of a series that is also nature-based. You'd be surprised. And I said, okay, I need everything done for your stuff. I'll only have about a half an hour a day for doing Jane Yolen stuff. And I took myself two highlights and booked myself into a cabin where I didn't have to speak to anybody for 5 days. And I sat down and wrote my 1,500 words. Are they good words? No, they are not. That is the first draft. But I knew that in order to get those good words, I needed to put that draft down. And so I know when to take myself out of the place where websites need to be done and packing needs to be done and taxes need to be done and emails need to be answered and fan mail needs to be answered. And I need to take myself out of that situation. Oh, also laundry needs to be done and the cat needs to be dealt with. And so I know when to take myself out of that and give myself a big block of time when I have something like that that needs to be handled. And I took that 4-hour drive, as I'm going to circle back, because I took that 4-hour drive in silence to work out the plot of that book that needed to be put on paper. So my writing schedule is not a straight line. It is what needs to be done. When I have a deadline, I drop everything and I do that. And then I go back to doing the other things.
Honestly, Heidi, I don't know of too many writers that don't have a second job, whether it's teaching, writing articles. And these are authors with multiple books published. And obviously, there are quite a few authors who do not have to have a second job. And that's fantastic.
Yes. And they have an assistant to do the things that they don't like to do.
Yes, they have a Heidi.
They have a Heidi.
Heidi, can you share your publishing story from the first finished manuscript to finding an agent and a publishing deal?
Oh, yes. See, this is, again, I have to talk about my great privilege in this industry, which is I was born with an agent because my mother works in here in the business. So after that first short story, my mom was asked to write a book about monsters and she says, I don't want to do it. Because it's a highly researched thing and I don't have time for it. But I'd do it if my daughter and I did it. So my first book out was Meet the Monsters. And it was 13, not poems per se, but sort of poem-esque ways that kids could read. And they were about different historical monsters, highly researched, and how you could get rid of a monster. So sort of how not to be afraid of monsters. And that was finished the week before I had my daughter, Madison. And then, so from there, I was a single mom. Well, I wasn't single at the time, but I became a single mom later. And I did my first maybe 10, 15 books are co-authored with my mom. And my brother calls this writer's college, like getting your master's degree in writing, working with my mom, because she's not sweet about it, which is good. We learn critique. We learn revision. And then when my daughter sort of got older and I started writing my own books, I sort of moved into that. And now I have coming out a couple books with my, I think maybe just one co-authored book coming out and about 10 solo books. So I moved into that. That being said, my agent at the time, Marilyn Marlowe, used to like to say, I changed your diapers right over there on that very sofa.
Oh my gosh.
So I sort of moved into having an agent just in that way. Marilyn has passed since, but our agent, Elizabeth, sort of took over her clients. And so I've grown with Elizabeth, which is really lovely. So that being said, my stuff may get onto a desk more easily than others, but I have a million rejections to show you that that does not get you a contract.
And that's great for other writers who are listening to hear. Every creative person I know has been rejected at some stage in their life, and it's awful and it hurts, but the fact is, it's just a part of getting your work out there.
I've explained it. I've explained it to Dennis that a writer's job, my job, he always was, but you love your job. Yeah, I absolutely love my job. I don't want to be doing anything else. But one of the things that writers need to know is that my job is about 80, 90% people telling me how awful I am. I get rejections more than I get acceptances. I accept that as part of the process. I have to listen to critique. So when I do something I'm proud of, I send it to my best friends and they read it and tell me the parts that are not good. It makes it better. It is part of my job. I accept it. I actually quite like it. Then you send it out to your agent who tells you it's not good yet and sends it back to you and you work on it more. And then you have to send it out for people to reject it in the marketplace. After that, you have to deal with reviews. So you have to have a solid belief in yourself and what and your creative babies that you're putting out into the world.
You've mentioned a little about how much your children, your mother, Jane Yolen, and your siblings have influenced your writing. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
It is amazing in this sort of solitary career to have a family who you talk about these things with. It's amazing. We get together and with all apologies to all of our significant others, we talk about books. We talk about writing. We talk about what we're writing. My brother and I went with his wife and Dennis away together. And in the evenings, Adam and I would read each other our poetry that we were working on. Our poor significant others were either talking about birds or books, and we get a lot of eye rolling, but it keeps us close in a fun kind of way. My daughter has 2 published picture books now, even though she says, Mom, I'm not becoming a writer. I'm becoming a lawyer. Good. We love that. A paycheck is a beautiful thing. My brother Adam's daughter, Ari Stemple, has her first co-authored with my mom picture book coming out. So we're really proud. It's a family discussion all the time. And in that way that we complain about our family time, that we kind of have grown apart and we don't have anything in common anymore, our family has that in common. And we've all been characters. I have been, until Adam's children have grown, I have been the strong female character in all of his adult fantasy novels. And, you know, I can find myself in their writing and their creative endeavors and vice versa. So it's a bonding thing. It really is a beautiful bonding thing. And where other people have a very solo career, we have these our own solo careers, but we can talk about it together.
You are so lucky. I'm sure that's a rarity.
It's really great.
Yes, it is. Now, apart from your own books, is there a book that you like to suggest other people read? A book that you love? And what are you currently reading?
So I just finished judging a national contest. I was one of 3 judges with Don Tate and Moon Tai Van. I want to give her name the proper accents. We were the judges on the Margaret Weiss Brown Award. And this year we just finished and it was announced. So I would love to suggest that people read the winners of that award. So the award went to Hannah Stiefel for The Tower of Life, which is how Yaffa Elash rebuilt her town and stories and photographs. It's illustrated by Susan Gall. I'll show you. I know that people won't see it, but it's a nonfiction picture book. It's absolutely gorgeous. It is about a town that during the war was destroyed, and people, and including Yaffa's family, ran off into the forest to survive the Holocaust, and how she helped create a memorial of her town, which was almost entirely destroyed. It's beautiful. It's a great picture book. And the honor book was called Too Early. It's by Nora Erickson and pictures by Ellie McKay. And it is a perfect read aloud for young kids who get up too early in the morning.
That was definitely me as a child.
Wasn't it all of us? So it's a perfect book. So I absolutely wanted to suggest those this year as wonderful picture books. Honestly, I could sit here for hours and tell you all the picture books and things that you could read.
Is that a kitty I see?
That is Romeo. That is Romeo.
A ginger male.
Yes. He likes to be involved on anything in Zoom. And what I've found for years and years of doing school visits, I know you always have to show a picture of your pets. I tell the kids it's the law. But now when I'm in schools on Zoom, Romeo likes to get right up involved in it. And I'm on the smallest little table. So he is a 17-pound cat who gets up on the table with me.
I also have a ginger male cat. I just love them. I love them. And I could talk about cats and dogs all day. So let me ask you, what are you currently reading?
What I'm reading right now, I almost always have several books going at the same time. So I'm listening to the audiobook of The Life and Crimes of Hoodie Rosen, which is about an Orthodox Jewish boy moving into a new town. Very interesting, by Isaac Bloom. That's what I'm listening to. And I'm reading A Time to Dance by Padma Venkatraman, which is about a beautiful Indian dancer. And these are more in the, I think Hoodie Rosen would be considered upper middle grade, but it could be YA. I'm not all the way into it, so I don't know the conflict yet. So yeah, that will sometimes tell me. But I'm almost always reading middle grade books, and that's my sweet spot. I mean, they're written so beautifully and so, I don't want to say gently, because it's definitely not gently, but there's so much thought into it. And I would, you know, like to put a shout out to the books that are being the most banned. I think the top three books that people are trying to ban. I don't want to get political, but
it's hard not to. Everything is political.
Yeah. And I've read all three of these books. I think there's a fourth and I'm not remembering. Flamer by Mike Carrotta. It's a graphic novel, a coming of age graphic novel. Beautiful, beautifully done. Genderqueer, which is a graphic novel about, I believe, I read it a while ago, a non-binary protagonist about this person's life. And All Boys Aren't Blue, which is also about the intersectionality of the character. It's not a character, it's this boy's actual life, this young man's actual life, of his queerness and his blackness. And people, those are the top three books people are trying to take out of libraries. And absolutely literally in the first chapter of All Boys Aren't Blue, the writer says, if this book had been written when I was a teenager, I wouldn't have had to write it. And if that doesn't say everything about why these books should be in libraries, I don't know what to say about it. So I just would love to give a shout out to those three books and every librarian who's out there on the front lines fighting this ridiculousness about access to books. Because, you know, it's not the people who fight for access to books who have children who are denied the access to these books. And I hope everybody's paying attention and voting in their school board elections.
Yes, because I think we often tend to forget that many of these decisions are made in our local communities. And by voting, particularly in our local school districts, we can stop this ridiculousness from happening.
It's criminal and it's heartbreaking because we have seen over and over again, especially, I mean, really in children's literature, we know the people whose books are being banned. Like I said, Mike Carrotta. I don't know the authors of the other two books, but Mike Carrotta, who wrote Flamer, wrote and illustrated, which is based, I mean, it's not about him as a kid, but it is not completely about him as a kid. And I know him, and I know that I know the psychic toll it takes. People will say over and over again that, oh, well, I'd love my book to be banned because then it'll be in the news and more people will buy it. That's not what this is about. This is about taking it off the shelves and out of the hands of the kids who really need that window to see themselves in books. Well, absolutely, but we're not changing those hearts and minds now, are we?
And there are also parents that need to read these books. I've had a couple of authors on the show, mothers whose children have changed gender. We also need to make sure these books are kept in libraries. They are needed. They support parents and help them to understand their children. And I'll make sure to put the books you've mentioned, along with the books that I've just talked about, in the show notes of this episode.
I love that. Thank you. Yeah. And you can hear from the books that I'm recommended, the three that are most, it is queer voices that are being silenced.
And ethnic voices.
Yes. Yes. So we need more voices to amplify the voices. So we need Diverse Books is an amazing organization that works within the children's book realm, making sure that we have enough voices. My particular platform, because this is my family and friends, is the LGBTQ plus books. I at one point thought, well, I can shout it as much as I want, but how do I put my money where my mouth is? And I work a lot with Highlights Foundation, which I've mentioned a couple of times, where I go in Pennsylvania to hide myself away and write those big groups of words. And I've been working with them and with individual donors. And we started the Kidlit Pride Scholarship. So if you are a person who identifies within the LGBTQ plus background, you can apply for that scholarship. And you can get time there or classes there in order to, you know, move your own writing forward and work within your journey to publication. So that I'm really proud of. And there are scholarships all over the place for all sorts of different people. A lot of them you can find on We Need Diverse Books. I just happen to, my platform generally happens to be the queer voices.
And as I said earlier, I will make sure to put all of this information in the show notes.
It's very exciting to have you put them up. That'd be great.
It will be my pleasure. Heidi, it's been lovely chatting with you. I think you and I think very much alike.
Well, thank you so much, Mandy. It was super fun. Happy reading.
You've been listening to my conversation with children's fiction and nonfiction author Heidi Stemple. To find out more about the Bookshop Podcast, go to thebookshoppodcast.com and make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. You can also follow me at Mandy Jackson Beverly and the Bookshop Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and on YouTube at the Bookshop Podcast. If you have a favorite indie bookshop that you'd like to suggest we have on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you via the contact form at thebookshoppodcast.com. The Bookshop Podcast is written and produced by me, Mandy Jackson Beverly. Theme music provided by Brian Beverly, executive assistant to Mandy, Adrian Otterhan, and graphic design by Francis Farala. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.